On va recommencer. Merci de notre presque assiduité. On y est presque. On a un après-midi encore très chargé, surtout si l'on veut profiter de la fin de l'après-midi pour avoir une discussion, parce que je suis certaine que les présentations de ce matin et de cet après-midi vont susciter énormément de questionnements et de croisements d'idées. Afin de commencer à répondre aux hypothèses énoncées par Adélaïde Remich ce matin. Apparently, the blogosphere has gotten hold of what we're doing here. I like this. I'm not a really blogosphere person, but I like to hear this. And I'll just point it out because I think this is wonderful. That yesterday, the information reached Norway. Somebody jumped on a plane and is here and is telling us that this is actually very important because the sort of crossing between judiciary and gender issues is certainly not new, although it's not dated. But adding the dimension of legal cultures as a focus of analysis is actually relatively novel. So we might be scratching the surface, but it's a good beginning of a scratch. So I think that's very very positive. Now this afternoon we will again travel to the common law world, the other big common law world. To the United States with Judith Resnick, and then travel the world in international courts with Nunke Grossman. Judith Resnick teaches so many courses, it's incredible. Federalism, procedure, courts, equality, citizenship, you name it, at the Yale Law School. She also holds a 5-year term appointment at the Faculty of Laws at the University College London. She's a trustee of the International Association of Women Judges, and we've had a brief discussion earlier about the importance, perhaps, of connecting this event with the International Association, perhaps more formally. Professor Resnick has appeared before the Supreme Court and numerous times has testified before the U.S. Congress, as well as the House of Commons in Canada. She has co-authored and authored pages and pages of books and articles, but more recently, Representing Justice, Invention, Controversy, and Rights in City-States and Democratic Courtrooms with Dennis Curtis. This book has received a number of awards, and a New York Times review has described it as an obsessive tour of Western art through the lens of law. So it's again a crossover, which is particularly interesting. Also worthy of note in the context of this conference would be Migrations and Mobility, Citizenship, Borders, and Gender, which Professor Resnick has co-authored with Seyla Benhabib. Professeur Grossman, qui maîtrise très bien le français, je la présenterai donc en français, enseigne le droit international de l'environnement et le droit pénal international à l'Université de Baltimore, aux États-Unis également. Ses recherches portent sur la légitimité des cours internationales, sur la présence fort limitée des femmes au sein de ces juridictions. Avant de se joindre au monde académique, elle a travaillé comme avocate au sein de grands bureaux de litige et d'arbitrage international et notamment agi comme conseil du Chili et de l'Uruguay devant la Cour internationale de justice. Donc elle a eu une expérience de première main devant cette Cour internationale. Parmi ses récentes publications, on épinglera notamment Sex on the Bench, that should interest students, but the follow-up is Do Women Judges Matter to the Legitimacy of International Courts? Voilà, alors sans plus tarder, je vous cède la parole. Merci beaucoup.
Hello. I'm very pleased to be here and want to thank all the energy of all the conveners. And I also want to thank the translators who have an unquestionably challenging job, and I hope I won't speak too quickly for them. You might notice that the program says Representing Justice, but the PowerPoint reflects that my title of this talk has changed. The question is representing what? Because my question is how to understand the relevance of the introduction of women to the judiciaries, the growth in the United States of women on judiciaries, and the big so what question, why does it matter, and if so, how? What is it that women today operating as judges on benches might, could, do, represent? And to forecast my conclusion, I am extremely far away from being what in the States we would call a gender essentialist, which is to say that I live in a country in which the last week, women, a three-judge court comprised of women, just overturned a lower court that had found that a law violated the U.S. Supreme Court's protection of women's rights to abortion, and that in another court, another senior woman jurist held that corporations had rights of free exercise and therefore, as a religious matter, could refuse to provide contraception under our new health care law. So I think it's very important to generate people we want to call feminist judges. I think it only happens through forms of collective action, and therefore I think that it is essential to understand the relationship between individual actors and the political, social culture of which we are a part, and affect us. And with that in mind, I'm going to give you a rapid overview of about 150 or so years in the United States and start here, the historical context. So this is a statute from 1851. In the US, states run the admission to the bar if you want to practice law. And the state of Iowa had a statute in 1851 that said any white male citizen of the United States inhabiting and satisfies it could become a member of the bar. Now, a group of men in 1869 read this statute, this is right after our Civil War, and considered the application of a woman named Arabella Babb Mansfield, and they decided that she was eminently qualified to be admitted to the bar, and then a local judge decided that he could not read the statute to do injustice, and therefore, despite the plain text, decided that she, a white female, could become a member of the bar. So the first woman recorded ever to be a lawyer in the United States is recorded as a member of the bar, is recorded in 1869, coming in under a statute that on its face plainly could be read to exclude her. Well, as part of an important group of people, she then helped, along with others, to rewrite. So by 1872, Iowa had changed its law so that it then said that he or she, and it takes away both the racist characterization of the law as well as its gender exclusivity, and it is no longer white and male. Now, this is the same era to give you the context. This is the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, which is our Equal Protection Clause, and which says all persons born or naturalized, et cetera, shall have the rights. No state shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, and the key phrases that do so much work these days, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor equal protection of the laws. Now, were I telling a cheerful story, I'd say fait accompli, even borrowing a French phrase, and say, look what happened. But instead what happened is the U.S. Supreme Court read these very words extremely restrictively and upheld soon after this provision came into effect, our Constitution was amended, black butchers, African American butchers in Louisiana were barred from being butchers, whites were given a monopoly, and the U.S. Supreme Court said that's a matter of state law, not of privileges or immunities. And when another woman named Myra Bradwell knocked on the door to be a member of the bar of the state of Illinois, the Illinois Supreme Court said, you really are not a full contracting juridical person, so you can't be a member of the bar. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, that's a matter of state law. These provisions provide no protection for you. So we understand that at the national level, the idea of equal protection of the law did not protect many of the people whom we might think it would have protected. Nonetheless, in small ways, and particularly in states around the United States, a few women made it both into the bar and onto the bench. And so I can give you a chart that's not easy to read from a distance, in fact, probably impossible to read from a distance, but it says that in 1870, a woman named Esther Morris became the first justice of the peace, the first judge in the United States. And this chart runs through about 15 jurisdictions and ends up in 1939, when a woman named Jane Bolin becomes the first African-American woman to make it on the bench in the state of New York. Now, the story of the first woman coming into Wyoming needs this, which is Wyoming was the first in the United States to change and then keep a law that says every woman of the age of 21 can vote, which is to say to think about the role of women as judges without thinking about the role of rights more generally is to misunderstand the conversation we need to be in. That women get to be juridical actors when they also get to be holding property, when they can keep their earnings, when they can go to various work and professions, and when they can vote. And in fact, and perhaps ironically, the reason Esther Morris got to be a judge is that when this was passed in the state of Wyoming, in the territory of Wyoming, before it became a state, there was a man so annoyed at the idea that a woman got votes that he resigned from being the justice of the peace, and she had the open slot. So she got selected for the slot because he said, I don't want to be a part of this for a while. The other is, before we think unmitigatedly cheerfully about the idea of look at this equality provision in Wyoming, certain of the proponents of it surely wanted equal treatment for women. But some of the proponents, what they wanted to do was try to dilute the vote of the newly enfranchised blacks. So they wanted to have more women vote because they were actually racist. So we're looking at a complicated story about the interaction, intersection between women, gender, age, racism, social and political movements, and slowly a few firsts are making it onto the bench. And remember, I mentioned to you that in 1939, the first woman African American, decades after the first white woman, became a judge in the state courts of New York and in the family court, which fits the story we heard this morning. So then again, I'm now in the 1930s, the late 1930s. Go from New York, where a black woman makes it onto the bench, to Aiken, South Carolina. This is the southern part of the United States, and in the middle of the Depression, the U.S. government is giving money and funds to artists to build courts, to build artists, to paint, to try to help deal with people who are completely out of work. So an artist gets this commission, and this is a justice image, because women, we're talking about women as judges, the icon of justice, the virtue justice, is a female body that dots many courthouses around the world. So our artist says, I'm not going to use a scale or a sword, but I'll put her in red, white, and blue, titling her the protector and the avenger, and this is installed behind a great big bench in a new courthouse for the federal government in the South. What is it that other people see when they look at this? A barefooted mulatto woman wearing bright hued clothes. A monstrosity, says the judge whose bench is supposed to be behind. What happens? There's a huge controversy because the view is that a dark-skinned woman couldn't provide the right image for the virtue justice. The artist offers to repaint. The federal officials think that's a good idea. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's protests, and in the end, what you see here, if you look now at this picture, which I'm showing you again, there are curtains on both sides because she's draped. So she's hidden because she's seen as unsightly, because dark-skinned women can't be representing justice in the U.S. courts at the time. The very same years, this is another image, a mural from Idaho, which is the Northwest, and this is an Indian about to be hung, and no one thinks it needs to be draped because they think it's okay to show this image on the walls. What I'm telling you about is in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, in the United States, despite our equal protection guarantees, neither mulattoes or dark-skinned women and men or people named Indians, were doing well as a matter of law, and what you see on the walls is mirroring the substance of the laws that we're dealing with. Now come to a pretty, to an image you might know. This is the front facade of the U.S. Supreme Court. The building opens for the first time, our Supreme Court gets its own building, in 1935. You may not be able to read well, but at the very top it says, equality under the law. Those words were picked because the architect said they'd fit the space, not because they're a quote from anywhere. They become quoted in a whole lot of instances, but this isn't what the world of the U.S. law looks like, as I just told you. It's not till 1954 that the U.S. Supreme Court finds unconstitutional racial segregation in schools, legally organized by race schools. And it's not till 1971 that the U.S. Supreme Court says that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment protects women from being discriminated against as a matter of script in the laws themselves. So when you look at this next picture, which is our current U.S. Supreme Court with three women and one African-American man, I invite you to understand how radical and recent and modern this invention of courts as democratic venues is, that not 50, 60 years earlier, a dark-skinned woman couldn't represent justice, and now we are here looking at a bench of people who are now seen as requisite to the legitimacy of courts, that women and men of all colors can be members of the bench. So now if I'm leaping to the current story in the United States, I'm now echoing some of the materials you've heard earlier this morning, but en passant, and we'll sit with the U.S. for a little bit more. Women in the U.S. courts around last year are roughly between a quarter and a third. They're slightly higher in this public service position than they are in private law firms. And an organization called the National Association of Women Lawyers also tells us that women are systematically underpaid in some of their private positions as well. I'm showing you another chart that you can't read, but I'm showing it to you on purpose in a way this way, which is that since about a dozen years ago or so, there have been compendium for a long time listing every judge in the United States. We've got thousands of them. And now this volume to be purchased, a commercial book, has a gender diversity study and survey which goes state by state and court by court to tell you whether there are more or less women this year than last year. And I'm asking you to remark on the remarkable point that women become a category of analysis and a data point for ostensibly legitimacy of the courts by this tracking system. This is the outgrowth, the pictures of the U.S. Supreme Court and these charts, of social movements that have made women count to be counted as a category of analysis. But I am a skeptic of body counts alone, because body counts just tell me some very essentialist category, women and men. And courts are the creators of norms. I'm a common law lawyer, but I think it's actually true in civil countries too, and in the international tribunals as well. They create norms in a variety of ways, through opinions and in some instances through collective actions of judges. The lack of any women on a bench is surely a marker of inequality, but I'm not confident that the presence of women on benches is a marker of equality. So let me tell you just a little bit about the idea in the United States. We have a great many collectivities, collective action of lawyers and of law professors and of judges. And this brief overview will give you from the late 1870s, when the American Bar Association is created. Notice that there's a National Association of Women Lawyers, which is a tiny group of 20 people when it starts in 1899. Associations of law schools come into being, and then the federal judiciary creates its own executive body of judges in 1922. Lawyers and judges come together to create something called the American Law Institute. By 1925, there are enough African-American lawyers that they create something called the National Bar Association. and the state courts all come together through their infrastructure in 1949. As these associations do, they lobby for funds, they lobby for authority, they lobby for jurisdiction, they protect lawyers' interests and the like, women and men of all colors are becoming part of the body politic. So the next slide tells you that between 1940s and the 1990s, new groups of people come into being. Subdivisions, coalitions, disagreements. The National Association for Colored People, concerned about the plight of African Americans, creates its own legal defense and education fund, which litigates the desegregation of schools and much else. The Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, National Conference of Women and the Law. Law students are central to this story. Women's rights reporters. The Judicial Council of the National Bar Association, founded in 1971, means there are enough black judges in the United States to have their own identity-based organization. And in 1979, the National Association of Women Judges. There are enough women judges that they come together to create an association of women judges. And then in 1991, an International Association of Women Judges comes into being as well. Along this list are some organizations that would understand themselves as politically progressive, and there are other organizations that would understand themselves very proudly as politically conservative. The Federalist Society, for example, corporate counsel associations that are very much committed to various forms of the status quo. So what do focusing back on women and gender and judging, what does the National Association of Women Judges do in the name of women and judging? In 1979, when they're founded, they support the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. It hasn't passed, so we have our general Equal Protection Clause, but not one specifically banning the lack of protection based on sex or gender. They are seeking appointments of women to benches, and they're seeking to prevent judges from belonging to clubs that discriminate against women. In some ways, elitist organizations of women lawyers and judges can be labeled elitist because, after all, in terms of the class conversation we were having before, all of us are relatively well-to-do, if not extremely well-to-do, as compared to the world around us. But one of the things that's been very important about the National Association of Women Judges is it's actually all about, or a huge amount, not only about getting more of themselves on the bench, but about thinking about the discrimination that women face in their courts and in the world at large. So they're caring about equal rights, and they're caring about fairness and equality and equal access to justice, which means they're supporting acts like the Violence Against Women Act, they're supporting activities dealing with women prisoners, they're supporting activities dealing with discrimination against women in courts. Women who go on the bench find out that they are sometimes discriminated against. Lawyers are discourteous to them. Their colleagues don't take them seriously. So they're worried about gender bias in courts, but they're also worried about the gender bias they see litigants encounter when the judges are sharing the stereotypes of the defendants being sued, for example, for sex discrimination. So they generate things called gender bias task forces. They get the chief judges of states across the United States to authorize research projects. Where is gender? How does it affect litigants? How does it affect the law? And this 1984, the New Jersey, one of the first reports, says that stereotype myths, beliefs, and biases sometimes affect decision making in damages, in violence, in juvenile justice, in sentencing. Women and men are treated differently in courtrooms, in chambers, and in professional gatherings. Within short order, within 10 years or so, there are more than 60 reports on gender, race, and ethnicity in the courts, and many, many of them find patterns of discrimination in interactions, in the way lawyers treat, in the way judges treat, and in the substantive areas of law, and they make recommendations to change the rules of judging and the substantive law as well in order to affect this. The National Association of Women Judges helps become a prompt for the International Association of Women Judges, the IAWJ, whose 2013 goals are to pioneer judicial education, gender bias around the world. Will set up the conversation about the international courts, a global network of women judges, opportunities, leadership, collaboration. Brenda Hale, former president of this organization, maybe we'll talk to you about it more. Mary Davis is here as a managerial trustee of this organization. And as of this year, the last I knew, there were about 34 national organizations, the National Canadian Organization, here's the logo of the national organization in Zambia, that are organizations of women judges self-consciously constituted to pay attention to the problems of inequality in the law and not just the privileges of those who are on the bench. So now I could be providing a kind of progressive narrative of watch women grow, watch them come into their own, get their voice, and now help many, although there's a long way to go. But it's not just a completely cheerful story, because what I've been describing in the US terms would be affirmative action. You might call it positive discrimination or temporary measures if we're using the language of CEDAW. We're talking about affirmative efforts to change on grounds of equality, on grounds of sameness, on grounds of difference in terms of feminist theory. We're all the same, therefore we should be on the bench. Actually, we're different, therefore we should be on the bench. We're talking about it becoming a theory of legitimacy of courts, that courts have to look something like the body politic they represent. So we're changing the valence of what courts mean, and we're changing the valence of what women and men of all colors mean as well. And it turns out in the United States, this engenders a huge conflict, because there are a whole bunch of people who are extremely hostile to the idea of affirmative action and seek to retract whatever efforts have been. Their argument is that they're all for equality, been there, done that, we've got it, it's time to move on, stop using gender, race as categories of analysis, and move on beyond that. And so you can hear it in various forms, and I'm giving you the voice of one judge who's extremely opposed to these gender, race, bias task forces, bludgeoned, we've been influenced, bludgeoned to accept a profound change in outlook that will be expected to affect our substantive decisions. It's nothing less than frightening that a powerful ideological movement with hard political overtones could come so close to intimidating the federal judiciary. It has been launched, it should never have been launched, it has to be opposed everywhere. So this is the argument against affirmative action, claiming that law starts out neutral. Now, in terms of the facts of the matter, the idea that judges create task forces, in the United States, they create task forces all the time about a whole host of different things, including Youth Corrections Act and narcotics addiction rehabilitation and the like. So to say there's something aberrational about judges thinking about the administration of justice is simply an inaccurate description of the history of the American judiciaries. But holding that aside, what this diatribe against these task forces is bringing into the fore is the hostility against efforts to reconstitute American and international law to make it more egalitarian. And there's a way in which, of course, this is correct as well as it's wrong. It is an effort to re-understand what law is. It is saying, we are saying, law is unequal and it needs to be changed. So to say it's avowedly normative is correct, and we're debating what the norm should be. Earlier today, we heard a talk about the idea of the call for a third of all the consultative bodies here in Belgium, to be have no more than at least a third of women and men on all these bodies. We know parité in France, we know the directives on the corporate boards. And we heard the word quotas earlier as another way to try to push the changing the composition of the bench. And that effort was made, some of it in the United States. There was a statute in the state of Florida that said, when you're nominating people to be judges, every nominating committee has to include either a woman or a minority. Now, from a feminist perspective, you want to have, and a critical race perspective, your stomach hurts a little bit because it's not either a woman or a minority, because we intersect and there are women who are minorities. As a political matter, the requirement to include as selectors people who were either, and or both women and members of minorities did for a little while change the composition of who got nominated. A U.S. federal judge held that statute to be an unconstitutional race-based or gender-based affirmative action and struck the statute. And most recently, as in last term in the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court held, and there's a mistake on the slide, that's Justice Kennedy for the majority, held that you can't use race as a factor, or if you do, you have to have incredible interrogation and justify to a court. This is the University of Texas that is worried that there are too few African Americans as members of their student body that are taking, that it, so therefore the university takes race into account, and that their practice is held to be a problem for the U.S. Constitution. And the one African-American justice who sits on our Supreme Court adds his own voice, insisting that race should never be used. So his quote, "I would hold that a state's use of race in higher education admission is categorically prohibited." So this is the anti-affirmative action work. So summarizing, point one, courts were once deeply venues of inequality, not only in who were judges, but also in who was the law, what the law looked like that they were applying. Point two, when women get to be judges, it marks not only a status change for women, but also a status change for courts, who have to be understood as themselves being equal opportunity venues. And relates to the challenges and the possibility of equality in legal rights as well as inside courtrooms. Point three, using the category women is an over and missed description because not all women make it on the bench at the same time, nor are they all seen as equally worthy to be judges, my mulatto justice I mentioned before. So we have to disaggregate the category women. Point four, when women and men of all colors arrive on benches inside courtrooms, they see and understand that courts continue to be venues in which discrimination takes place, and some of them organize to try to prevent it. But please understand that the group that's organizing is by no means all the people who could be described as women and or of color. In the United States, the best guess right now, not counting the administrative judiciary, is there are around 10,000 women sitting as judges on the bench. The National Association of Women Judges right now has about 1,200 women members. The numbers get harder in French and English translations, so I'll say them one more time. 10,000 women as judges and about 1,200 women as active members in an organization committed to making equality more true. Now, there are a lot of reasons why people don't join, so that doesn't say that all those other women aren't involved in some way, but to remember that it's just not all who are women affiliating in this regard, and some that are doing remarkable things, not just at all for themselves. We just stopped the loss of a prison for women in the Northeast, so there's a great deal of activism, but it's not shared by all women judges. Point five is to say that the last 50-100 years is an inspiring description of all that social and political movements can do to change rights. And we can see the incredible importance of the impact. But we also have to understand that right now, we in the United States at least, are in a huge, and my understanding in some other countries as well, of a struggle in which conservative forces trying to dislodge or limit these rights claims are getting louder, winning in the electoral as well as in the legal, as well as in the judiciaries as well. And so we're in the struggle about whether the rights that exist are being taken away So we cannot in any way rest easy on our laurels, rest easily on our laurels. And so turn then to the next point, which this slide represents. In the United States, these are bar graphs. The federal courts about which I've talked and which you might hear more about are a tiny part of the filings in the United States. Most of the adjudication happens in the state courts, of which there are, like, not counting juvenile, family, and traffic, some 40 to 50 million cases filed every year. Courts are a remarkably successful social service, a great advertisement for government. People believe they have rights, people try to use them, people seek rights, and people believe they have a chance of being heard. What this also, so this represents that democracy has changed adjudication radically and made all sorts of new people rights holders. But what it also represents is that democracy challenges adjudication. Because when you look at these numbers, you have to realize that in the New York State courts alone, where Mary was a judge, 2.3 million people are civil litigants in those courts without lawyers, a lot in family disputes and in some household landlord-tenant disputes. If I go across the United States to California, 4.3 million people are civil litigants without lawyers in the state courts of California, whose court system themselves is economically stressed, and there have been many closings of courts, as I know there has been in the UK as well and elsewhere. In order to use courts, you need new positive rights. Just as equality for women was once a new right, and violence against women may be becoming a new right with the European Convention on Human Rights in that court, holding that Lithuania, for example, has to provide remedies for violence against women. So there need to be new rights to insist on the equipping of both courts and of their users so that people can bring claims and have a chance of fairly being heard once they get into court. But once again, in the United States, there's a real pressure to lower the funding of courts and to limit, and at the federal system, to not be providing much by way of new positive rights, where the points of light, if I will, are in the state courts. One of the great leaders for trying to equip those unrepresented civil litigants is in the state of New York, where Jonathan Lippman, the chief judge, is one of the best voices we've got in the country, saying new rights need to be created. Which is to get me to the final point, which is that you have to be very clear, to be utterly leery of this gender essentialism, that numbers alone of women on a bench is not a mark of celebration until we know what the commitments of the women and men are who are on the bench. And I know Sally Kenny's book and some others have written about the problems of trying to see whether women judge differently in any aggregate numbers as well. I mentioned and showed you before that this is from Australia. It's on the outside of one of its county courts. So women's body has long represented justice. But to do justice to justice requires much renovation of our iconic and our legal traditions. Justice was once one of four cardinal virtues, fortitude, temperance, prudence, as well as justice. This is just the tip of a virtuous iceberg of the kinds of work and a better representation of the needs for collective action by both women and men in order to bring any of the claims that women could represent equality on the bench to become true. Thank you.